Hello, and welcome to Endeavors. On today's show, actor and comedian and younger brother of Bill, Joel Murray. That's all coming up on today's show. Indecision keeps me up. I had a bit of an issue with the website last week, just some technical stuff, but it took a couple of days to get resolved, and that is why this episode is only going up now. Apologies to my guest, Joel Murray. Also, I want to say that if you are listening from Canada and you haven't yet voted, get out there and vote. Although by the time you listen to this, the results probably will already have come in, so I'm just going to say, happy voting. My guest today is an actor and comedian who has appeared in the television series Mad Men, Grand, Love and War, Dharma and Greg, and Shameless. He comes from an acting family, which includes the siblings Brian Doyle Murray, John Murray, and an actor you may have heard of, Bill Murray. In addition to his aforementioned TV credits, he has also appeared in Scrooge, Shakes the Clown, The Cable Guy, The Drew Carey Show, John Doe, Malcolm in the Middle, Still Standing, Joan of Arcadia, American Body Shop, Two and a Half Men, Criminal Minds, Cold Case, Hatchet, Criminal Minds, Suspect Behavior, the acclaimed Oscar-winning film, The Artist, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, Mike and Molly, Killing Regan, The Big Bang Theory, American Gods, and one of my favorite films, in which he played the lead, God Bless America. For the past few years, he has also been touring with the comedy troupe Who's Live Anyway, the live version of Whose Line Is It Anyway, with Ryan Stiles, Greg Proops, Jeff B. Davis, among others. And in 2014, he officially replaced Chip Esten while Chip was off making a little show called Nashville. He also appears as the voice of Don Carlton in the Pixar film Monsters University. He is Joel Murray, and he joined me last week to talk about his new film. Here is our conversation. Joel Murray, hello, good morning. Thanks for being here today.
Hey, good morning.
So you are part of a new film out, Holiday Hell. Would you consider yourself sort of a fan of the horror type films?
I am. I enjoy a good horror film. I've done a couple. I was in a movie called Hatchet and the sequel Hatchet 2, the Victor Crowley stories. But it's always fun to work on a horror film because you've got unique types that are drawn to them and like to work on them. And, in a perfect world, you do enough horror films, you can go to horror festivals and sit at a table and get paid to sign autographs all day. But I guess I got to get a few more under my belt to do that. But I've met some interesting people from doing it.
And of course, Holiday Hell is, there are four stories, each set during a different holiday. What was it about this particular script that attracted you?
Well, I was approached by Jeff Farrell, the director, producer, and I had worked on a movie called 7 Minutes years ago up in Everett, Washington. And I think his capacity on that was he was a driver, actually. And he said, you know, I've got this thing that you might be interested in. And I tour around the U.S. and Canada doing a Who's Live Anyway show, a live Who's Line show. And I don't have a lot of time to do films. And the thing about this was that, you know, here was a small film, but you got to be the star of a segment. And so it was all the fun of being in a big movie, but with, you know, one quarter of the commitment. So I was able to fit it in my schedule, and it turned out to be a really good time.
You know, you mentioned the interesting types that you often meet making horror films, and I think we've seen within the last 5 years sort of a revival of the intelligent horror film. What is it about that genre that is able to sort of convey maybe a socially conscious message that other forms of the medium aren't able to do as successfully?
Well, I guess they, horror films can grab your attention. You really are sucked in, you know, and so once you've got an audience sucked in, you've got 300 people in the dark, why not say something, right? I think Frank Capra said that originally, but it's got you, you know, on the edge of your seat, and you're wrapped into it. And our little segment, it's down and out guy. His wife's cheating on him. He gets no respect, and he ends up, you know, fighting back at everybody that is making his life hell and holiday hell. It all just happens right around that Christmas time, which can be a depressing time for many people. And I just had a good time doing it. When I saw the script, I said, you know, I could rip this up. This would be really fun. And it was low budget, and you know, there was some things that were interesting in the fact that, like, when I beat up the bartender in the alleyway, we staged our own combat there, and there was a good amount of trust that you know, that guy let me, you know, swing a axe handle or a bat, whatever it was, a bat that close to his face and stuff like that. But that was part of the fun of the genre, is that, you know, you've got to make the magic, and sometimes you've got to make it yourself.
The film also kind of doubles as a holiday film, you know, given its premise. Do you like sort of those types of films, and how can somebody make a good holiday film for you? What are the ingredients for that?
Well, ordinarily, you know, it's got to touch the heart, and holiday films, you know, they come back, they return. I mean, I was in Scrooge many years ago. I had the illustrious role of party guest number one, but there's a movie, I know people that watch Scrooged every Christmas, you know, every year. I don't do any shopping till I see Scrooge, but it's one of the things that they will come back over and over and over again. So if you do a good one that it touches people, usually it's, you know, heart touching, but this one, if it, you know, you give somebody a good scare, they're going to come back to it time and time again. I think this one is going to hold up. It's fun in a, you know, a grindhouse way. It'll be back. It'll haunt you.
You mentioned you do a lot of touring with the live show. Who's Live Is It Anyway? Of course, based on the classic Whose Line Is It Anyway? How did you first become involved with those guys in that gang? I know, I think Jeff has a small part in your film as well, but how did that whole relationship begin?
Well, I was on a television series out in Los Angeles back in like 89 when the Second City opened up in Los Angeles. They had a short-lived Second City in Los Angeles. It was only 2 or 3 years, and Ryan Stiles was in the company, and I used to fill in for guys. I would understudy, basically, when, you know, guys would get a gig, they'd get a week on a TV show or something like that. I would fill in, and Ryan and I have been friends since 89, and we did some kind of fundraiser thing about 8 years ago, And I stepped in. They put me in this kind of a big group of improvisers. And Ryan gave me a call and asked me to fill in for The Weeknd about 7 years ago. And The Weeknd is still going. Jeff Davis has been in the group, Greg Proops and Ryan Stiles. And we alternate in with Dave Foley and Drew Carey and Chip Esten, the guy I replaced who was on Nashville. And like last night we were out with Jeff Davis. It was his birthday. So they haven't kicked me out because I can, you know, keep up with them drinking. I think they like that about me. But when I got offered to do this, Jeff Farrell, the director-producer, was looking for somebody for the other role. And I like, oh, I work with a guy. He's a perfect jerk. He'd be great. but Jeff Davis is a really nice guy, but he can play a kind of a sleazebag. And I talked him into doing it, and he didn't know anything about any of these people, and he kind of took a leap of faith, and he ends up getting, you know, nail gunned in the crotch. So he had some fun doing it, though, as well. He had a nice part. It was very good.
Well, you know, what's it like for you whenever you make a project or work on something, working with people that you already have a pre-existing relationship with? Does it make your job overall easier, would you say?
Yeah. You know, I can trust Jeff on stage with no lines, you know, when we're making it up. So we have a certain rapport, and it does make it easier. And in this movie, you know, there were four directors, and you know, so in some of the, like our segment, there were two directors around all the time, and then I'm a member of the DGA. So we were able to consult and you know, throw out ideas and think of different ways of doing things, and everybody was pretty flexible, which, you know, is inherent in being in an improv group. You got to be flexible. Just goofy things like, you know, you're going to kill a guy with a nail gun. Well, a nail gun should have a compressor and a hose attached to it. So I said, well, what if we took that plastic bottle over there and we put some kind of, you know, taping on it to make it look like it's actually compressed air, and then we can justify killing a guy with a nailed gun. And everybody's like, oh, yeah, great, good, you know. So there was some yes-anding on the set as well, you know.
Working with multiple directors at one time can be a challenge. How did you find that experience?
Well, we, you know, there was only one director per segment kind of thing, but we did have three directors in the room kind of. So that just, you know, led to a conversation and made it, you know, flexible. And it wasn't like there was any kind of power struggle or anything like that. It was just more cooks in the kitchen, and it didn't mess up the soup. You know, it was fun that way.
Now I know you come from Chicago, which is, other than New York and LA, is probably the biggest comedy city in the States, if not the world. How do you think that environment growing up has influenced where you are in your career?
Well, Chicago actors, you know, there's a ton of theater here, and it thrives, and people support it. It's a great theater town. And when I first moved to L.A., I would go into auditions, and I would, you know, have my audition memorized, and casting people would be surprised, like, wait, you've memorized it. Well, yeah, I just thought I should. I could play the part better that way. Oh, well, are you from Chicago? Yeah, but I mean, Chicago is a do-the-work kind of town. You know, an actor prepares here, and they do the work, and they don't think it's going to be handed to them, and you realize that you've got to be on the stage for, you know, 5,000 hours before anybody's going to give you anything for free, as compared to Los Angeles, where, you know, people think if they put up a good YouTube video, they should have their own sitcom. But I it's a working man's town, Chicago, and that's where I come from. I grew up working construction and caddying and doing all kinds of jobs, and before I became an actor. And I like to work. That's part of the reason I got in this film.
Given that you have
three brothers also in the industry. When you first became an actor, was it hard trying to, because people were looking for, you know, Bill or Brian or whoever. So what was it hard trying to forge your own identity, or did you embrace the fact that you were a part of this amazing comedic family and were able to, quote unquote, piggyback off the back of them?
Well, I haven't gotten a lot of nepotism out of those guys. I spent, you know, my early career trying to find out what I do that's unique and what I do that's funny. And I did my best to not be Bill Murray and not to be Brian Murray. And so, I mean, the Second City is great for that. You know, you're 300 nights a year, 300 plus nights a year in front of a full audience. You really get to figure out what it is you do that's funny. And it's one of the greatest training opportunities anywhere, to be able to get up there every night and spend those hours on the stage. And so I always tried not to be Billy's brother. And it's funny, now we have a clothing line, William Murray Golf, and after all the years of trying not to be Billy's brother, I walk around with his name on my back of my shirt all the time, because I got to wear this stuff because I'm a part owner. But, you know, they're wonderful comedic examples, as well as dramatic actors, both of them. So I had, you know, I had good people to draw from, but I did my best to figure out who I was. And, you know, as far as maybe you get an extra audition here and there because they want to see what Bill Murray's little brother's like, you know, you got to show up to the game, and you got to carry the ball yourself when you get in the audition. And I've been fortunate. I've had a nice career, but I don't have to deal with the celebrity that Billy does. A little mild-mannered, mediocre career is awfully nice sometimes.
Is it the type of career, the type of relationship where you can discuss work and projects with your family, or do you largely try to separate that?
My brothers are funny. They don't talk about the business much at all, ever. You know, like Brian was in As Good As It Gets with Jack Nicholson. Never mentioned it. I went and saw it in the theater. They're like, oh, there's Brian. But, oh, yeah, I had a part in that. That was fun. But, you know, we don't talk, we talk sports, we talk family, we talk other things, but we don't really talk about the business much. It's surprising.
You know, being from Chicago, of course, Bill was front and center when the Cubs won. Were you right there with him? Are you a huge Cubs fan as well?
I was a huge Cubs fan as well. I had gotten my own seats about 20 rows to the left of where Billy was, right behind home plate. So my seats weren't as good, but I was at all three World Series games in Chicago. And I would have gone to Cleveland, but my wife dragged me home because I had been on the road for about a month at that point, and she wanted me home. So I celebrated the win with my family back in Los Angeles.
What was that like for you? How nuts did that city go?
It was insane. And I have a son that lives here, and he had some great videos of, you know, popping champagne on Clark Street when they did finally win it. But I was, you know, apoplectic. I could not breathe. But it was one of those moments where, and it happened to me, I've coached a lot. I coached all my kids in football, baseball, and basketball. But we won a World Series with my son Gus years ago. And it's that moment when you win, it isn't so much complete elation and jubilation. It's the absence of losing. And it's like, oh, my God, we didn't screw up. We didn't mess it up. And it almost goes to like a weird all silence moment in a movie. And, you know, it's just all swirling around you, and you're just in shock that, oh my God, we didn't blow it. And they tried not to suck, and they didn't. They pulled it out, and it was unlike anything else in my life when the Cubs won it. And I wish I had gotten to Cleveland with those guys, but it was pretty good in Chicago when they won game five. that was electric. It was a heck of a night, and we were out with, you know, Billy and Eddie Vedder and all kinds of people, and that was a pretty jubilant evening, to put it lightly.
Who do you like on the Cubs right now?
I've gotten to hang with Rizzo a lot. He's a really solid guy. I mean, you can punch him. He's really solid. And Chris Bryant, they've got a good nucleus. I'm friends with Joe Maddon out of, you know, weird, you know, combination of things. And he's the greatest guy in the world, and I can't believe they let him go. He's one of those guys that'll talk baseball with you for 20 minutes, but then all of a sudden they'll look you right in the eye and goes, yeah, but what are you doing to make the world a better place? He's really a humanitarian and a real cool cat. And I'm sad that he's gone. I hope he comes out to the Angels, so I'll get to see him out in California a little bit. But they need pitching. You know, it's been the problem since the World Series, and they haven't really addressed it. And I would like to meet some really good pitchers on the Cubs, but I think there's room there. But they, you know, they've got some young players that are really good. And Javi Baez is one of the most exciting guys in sport to watch. He's really amazing. I mean, they've got contracts coming up. There could be big changes. I'm scared of what might happen. But I've been a Cub fan since I was, you know, born. And I've been through some bad times. And we'll always have 16. So that's something. I've been through the doldrums, decades of them, and I hope we don't go back that way. I hope the Rickets continue to improve the team.
Hey, I'm a Jays fan, so I feel you in that regard. You know, I've 15 and 6.
You had a good one with Joe Carter back in the day, right?
Yeah, and then in 2015, Batista hitting the most iconic home run in franchise history, against the Rangers.
And maybe the Maple Leafs will get it together someday.
Yeah, there's talk that we could finally take it this year, but we'll see. People need to stop jinxing us. Just one more note on baseball, forgive me. But you mentioned Joe Maddon. What do you think he meant to the Cubs in the city of Chicago?
Well, he was our baseball Phil Jackson. He had a unique way at addressing the kids, you know, the young players that he had. And he just has this kind of mentor vibe to him that, you know, he's seen everything, done everything. And he can comment on art and literature and all kinds of things the way Phil Jackson would. And he's just an all-round cool cat kind of thing. He was everybody's dad in this town for a while, he was just the hip uncle or whatever. So he did have a cool vibe, and you just trusted him. And God knows, in that World Series, he made some weird choices, some things he said he'd never do. He put Lester in with a man on base, and, you know, he pitched his closer 2 innings when he said he wouldn't, you know. It all came out in the wash. It all came out okay. But at the time, you were kind of like, what are you doing, Joe? So he's a little bit of a riverboat gambler, too. But I'm sad. I'm going to miss him. I'm going to miss him being around. I hope he comes out to the Angels.
I know we touched a little bit earlier on, you know, working with frequent collaborators. And one person that you've worked with throughout the years is Bobcat Goldthwait, and one of my favorite films years ago was God Bless America. Working with somebody like that over there, is what makes you keep coming back and rekindling and revisiting that type of collaboration? Not necessarily Bobcat specifically, but, you know, just in a general sense.
Bobcat and I have been friends since one crazy summer back in '85, and we hit it off right away, and we've kept in touch, and we've stayed friends all these years. And I did his first movie, Shakes the Clown, when he first started directing, and then I went and saw the film he did with Robin Williams called World's Greatest Dad, which I think is some of the best work Robin ever did, and I was just blown away. I'm like, wow, Bob has gotten really good. And I was very jealous that I wasn't in that one. And he was having some back surgery, so I sent him over the first four seasons of Mad Men when he was recuperating. And somewhere through season one, his wife turned to him and said, yeah, Joel should play Frank in God Bless America. And it hadn't occurred to Bob, but because we're old friends, and then he kind of put on, you know, crooked his neck a little bit and said, hey, yeah, you know, and he sent me the script. And I thought he was just sending it to me to say, you know, maybe you'd like to do one of these little parts. And I didn't realize he wanted me to do the lead. But what a great guy to work with. And he's collaborative, and he's really cool to work with. And his DP as well are really fun to work with. And, you know, I was a star of a Hollywood movie, but it was really low budget. So I was, you know, changing in my own van. And it was all the fun of being the star of a movie, but without any of the perks. And as Bob Jett says, my movies make hundreds of dollars. So it wasn't a big payday either. But I love Bob. I'd do anything for him. You know, he had his show Misfits and Monsters last year. I got to do a really nice part on one of those episodes. So he always just kind of thinks of me, and for some reason he thinks I'm his doppelganger and that we look alike and that we're very similar. Not at all, but if it gets me work, I'm fine with that. Yeah, we look exactly the same, Bob. I'm 6 inches taller than you. Anyway, but whatever.
I have hair. It's interesting you mentioned that, because you had mentioned that you took on Holiday Hell because it was sort of a role in one segment and you didn't have to be there for that long. And then with God Bless America, it was your first sort of leading man experience. What was being the lead, and you were there in pretty much every scene? What was that like for you?
Well, it's daunting. I mean, you know, some of those speeches I had in God Bless America were, you know, 3 pages long with just me speaking. And, you know, I had days where I had 4 friends and my wife in a day's shoot, and they're over on the side laughing it up and, you know, having a great time, and I'm in the corner just running lines with an Asian kid over and over again trying to get down these lines. And it was a lot of work. And in fact, I called Billy when I got the part, and I was going in to do whatever 31 days in a row. I was just going to ask him, you know, is there anything tip-wise that just, you know, how do you keep your health up, your stamina, and things like that? And he called me back like 32 days later, right after we had wrapped. Oh, that's too bad. Yeah, I could have had some good advice for you on that. Oh, so you're done, huh? Oh, well, next time. But it's a weird thing. People don't realize how hard it is to, you know, just have to memorize the stuff every day. And after working a 15-hour day, you go home and you've got to memorize all the stuff for the next day. And it's hard work some days being an actor, but that's the beauty of the gig I've got now. You don't have to memorize anything, you just make it up.
I hope you don't have to use the 1-800 number to get in touch with your brother.
He got a phone when we started having children. So there's people that are still using the 1-800 number, and I don't know how often he checks it, but he's got a cell phone. He's still got a BlackBerry. He's still trapped a little in the past, but he's reachable. He doesn't return calls immediately, but he's reachable at least. And we're kind of in business with this clothing line, so he's got to call me back.
When God Bless America first came out, I had the privilege of talking with Tara Lynn Barr, your co-star, and now I know that was one of her first big films. What do you enjoy about working with, you know, young up and coming actors?
Generally, I don't enjoy working with them, but she was an absolute joy. She was just a sponge. She wanted to learn everything she could, and she was always, you know, paying attention. And she wasn't, you know, think about it. You could have gotten a 16 girl that talked incessantly, but this girl was really great, and she was really cool, and she wanted to know everything about everything, and did it silently. But she was always paying attention and always involved, and she was just a wonderful energy too. She was fun to work with. She was, a real nice opposite to me. the way I was playing it. So she's fun to be around, and I've hung out with her, you know, a bit since then. And now that she's, you know, old enough to drink and stuff, she's really a fun character. She's a sprite, as they say.
You've jokingly mentioned drink a couple of times, and I know for myself, being in the business, a lot of collaborations can happen, you know, over a pint. For you, how important a part of the business is the social side?
You know, there's a good amount. I mean, there's a lot. I play a lot of golf, and there's a lot of talk on golf courses. You got 4 hours to talk with people, and you can find out their true character on the golf course a lot of times. But I'm, you know, I enjoy a good bar. There's no doubt about it. And Los Angeles, you got to go kind of far to meet up with people, and you got to drive everywhere. So you don't go out and drink as much as you do in Chicago or New York or Toronto, for that matter. We hang out with about 90% Chicagoans in Los Angeles. So we have a lot of barbecues, a lot of, you know, house parties kind of thing. And we have a pretty good crew of Second City people and, you know, Second City grads and Chicago actors that hang out together. So it makes L.A. fun. And, you know, after being there 30 years, we're still going, hey, it's 80 and sunny. How about this? You know, it's February. This is fabulous. So I'm still kind of on vacation after 30 years.
You mentioned Toronto, obviously, which is where I am. And you mentioned you were here recently for Who's Live. Where's your favorite place to drink in Toronto?
Oh, my favorite place is backstage, be it in Mississauga or Hamilton or, you know, we have a good time. We have a drink before we get up and do the improv. It just loosens you up and lets the tongue flow a little faster. I'm trying to think of where we were there. Where did we drink? I went to the Royal York. It's got a good bar there, and I fortunately had the guy that owns Buy-In Footwear paying for the drinks because they were pricey. But that's a cool bar. I don't know. I've been to weird after-hour clubs there where you have to buy like little beans that you trade in for drinks. It's it's not my favorite drinking time because the shots are very small. I think they pour them in thimbles there. When you get a drink, it's like, really? That's, can I get a double then? You know, anyway. There's a metric conversion that doesn't work for a Chicago. Shots seem to be a lot larger here.
Who is a better golfer, you or your brother?
Well, that's why we play, and it could be different any day. You know, growing up, my oldest brother was the best, but now he's 75 years old, and he's not as good as I am anymore. Billy and I are a pretty good match, and Brian's a good player. That's why we play. It could be any one of you on any given day, but Billy is the best heckler and can get in your head and kind of really get you going and ruin your game. But I don't know. I'll find out the next time we play who's the best.
You, of course, have mentioned a few times Who's Live Is It Anyway with Ryan and Greg and Jeff and a few others. What do you like most about that group and the touring life?
Well, I don't necessarily like leaving my wife all the time, but I do enjoy touring, and we've been, you know, in November we're going to get to Alaska. I will have performed in every state of the United States and most of the provinces. We haven't been out to the Maritimes and we haven't been to the Yukon, but we've been to most of the provinces in Canada. And you know, when we have an off day, we went to Banff, and me and the tour manager walked around. We took a big hike around a lake in Banff, and you get to see a lot of beautiful country, and be it U.S. or Canada. And you get to go to towns like Asheville, North Carolina is a fantastic town. I would have never gone there. I wouldn't have known it. But you get to visit a lot of really cool places because that's where the booking agent has sent you, and you wouldn't have gotten there otherwise. And, you know, in a country that's completely divided these days, you get to travel around and see that, you know, we are all, you know, one, and there shouldn't be this division in our country that there is, that's being done politically. But you get to see that, you know, hey, there are people just like us, you know, down in the South. They're normal people. They just, you know, they watch the wrong news channel. That's the only problem. I really enjoy the travel, local foods, you know, regional foods and things like that. It's fun. You know, these guys, you know, some nights we get done with the show, we go back to our rooms, and then some nights, you know, we go out on the town. It's a long road. We're on a 2-week stint right now, and we've got a day off, and I need a day off. I need to refuel and rest today. And we're in Chicago, so I'll probably just take a nice long walk on the lake. And I've got some work I've got to do. I've got some stuff I got to read, and I think I'm just gonna take it easy and not go out tonight after last night, which was Jeff Davis's birthday. So. You can imagine there was, we ended up in a karaoke kind of situation, singing at the Zebra Lounge till late. So, you've got to pace yourself.
Do you have a go-to karaoke song?
I like to do Brandy. If they've got it, I like to do, the Rolling Stones, Poison Ivy is an easy one to sing. I've got a few.
Chicago, of course, is a great comedy town, and you were just here in Toronto. What do you make of the comedy scene in our country?
Well, I mean, there's some great comics that are out of there, and you know, my brother Brian, I went stayed at the Royal York when I was about 12, and so when my brother Brian opened the Second City in Toronto. And you know, look at the people he got to work with, Gilda and John Candy and Aykroyd. And, I mean, it's great, but, you know, when you're on tour with a comedy group, you don't really go out and watch comedy on your night off or after your show. It's a little bit of a busman's holiday. So, I'm not sure what the scene is today. When I walked by the Second City, there was construction all around it. It looked like it could have used a good pressure washing on the outside. It was dust covered, but I don't know. I'm not hip to what the scene is there because, you know, we're kind of passing through.
I wanted to ask you about you got to be involved with Pixar a few years ago when you did Monsters University. What is the Pixar and voiceover experience? What was that like for you?
Well, that's the best gig in the world, working for Pixar. If you know, and supposedly once you're in, you're in. But I haven't been back since I got to be at Monsters University. But, you know, you go up there and, you know, they put you up in whatever hotel you want to be at in San Francisco. And I went up about 4 or 5 times, and each time I stayed at another great hotel in San Francisco, which was kind of fun. And, you know, they pay you well. The residuals are amazing. But it's a really cool process in the fact that they are constantly rewriting and kind of audience testing the material you've done already. And, you know, that whole campus there that Pixar has, you know, they demand that people have a certain amount of fun every day. And so there's, you know, people playing Ultimate Frisbee. There's people playing basketball. There's people doing yoga. There's people playing guitar. Outside on a lawn. It's really a cool place, and a lot of the offices themselves have little secret bars built into them, so a lot of people wanted Freddie Rumsen to sign their bar, so I got to see some of these like secret snugs guys had behind what, you know, was the business end of their little office, and behind it there'd be like a 4-foot by 6-foot bar and hidden behind a, you know, hidden panel kind of thing. But that's a great great gig if you can get a Pixar job. And you don't audition for those. They just call you out of the blue and say, we want you to do this part. And I hope they call again soon. But I worked with Dan Scanlon, was the director of that one, and he was wonderful. And he would work you for 4 hours, and you know, he would try to get your voice up to a certain level, octave wise. You know, he has a high voice, and he would, you know, keep working you until you got to a certain point. And then at the end, you would do all the yelling and all the impacts and stuff like that that's hard on your voice. So when you got done after 4 hours, a session like that, you had nothing left. You're downright exhausted. So it's a cool process, and they've got it down. And I hope I get a chance to be in another one soon.
You've done a lot of television spots over the years. I'm curious as to what the Charlie Sheen experience was like for you when you guest starred on Two and a Half Men.
Well, Charlie's a trip, and he's an old friend of Ryan's too. So he was always really nice to me because he knew I was friends with Ryan. He's an interesting cat. I remember one time, one of the first times I met him, he just kind of walked around me in 360 and was staring at me. He's like, so how old are you? Are you dyeing your hair? Is that natural? What is it? But he was kind of obsessed with his own aging, and he was looking at me as like maybe looking in the mirror in 5 years or 10 years. I don't know how much older I am than him. But yeah, Charlie's a trip. And John Cryer is a really sweet guy and a nice guy. They're fun to work with. I'm blessed that, you know, I was on Dharma and Greg for years. So Chuck Lorre every once in a while throws me a bone and says, yeah, I need somebody to just blow Ashton Kutcher some shit. Could you come in and do this part? Yeah, heck yeah. And that's another one where the residuals just keep coming, the Chuck Lorre gigs.
You've mentioned Freddie Remsen a couple of times, and of course that was your role on Mad Men, and that, I think that was a show that changed television in a way. You were on it for a number of seasons. What has that show meant to pop culture, and I guess to the shifting zeitgeist?
Well, it's on a, you know, you go to best of television lists, it's often, you know, in the top 10 of all time, and to be on one of the best shows ever made is something else. And everybody really loved going to work there. And so, I mean, part of that was the crew loved being there. The set designers loved being there. The actors loved being there. And you knew it was really cool from the get-go that you were doing something different. And, you know, look, it got Jeff Davis and Greg Proops wearing suits. You know, you look at back old Who's Lines, they have really, really kind of ugly, long, untucked shirts with the skulls on them and stuff like that. But now here they are with pocket squares and tight-fitting suits. It likened back to, you know, a time where, you know, people were a little bit classier looking, but, you know, may have been philanderers and adulterers at the same time. But, that was one where you had to bring your A game every day because, like, Elizabeth Moss and John Hamm both have kind of photographic memories. They had their stuff down, so you had to really, you know, come absolutely prepared, knowing every line, every comma. And you know, they would literally come over to you and say, you know, there's a comma in the middle of this run here, you're not saying. Like, what's a comma? Yeah, no, there's a pause there for a reason. And that was treated like absolute Shakespeare. There was no forumphing or, you know, riffing on that work. So that's, you know, it's a cool exercise to have to do it like that. And you don't always have that in the business. But the words were absolutely fantastic. And, you know, sometimes some of the scenes you just had to say them and you looked great because the words were so good.
Approach drama and dramatic work the same as you would comedy? Like, is your process the same?
But it's, you know, it's similar. You don't have to worry about getting laughs. So that's easier. But, you know, dramas are, they're fun to work on. And, it's, I've always in my career tried to do different things. When I was in the Second City, I left two different times to go do plays in Chicago. So I would write the show, put the show up, and then leave and go do a play for a little while and then come back and write the next show kind of thing. But I've always tried to, you know, do different things, and it's been beneficial because, you know, when one thing isn't paying off, one thing isn't working, you know, maybe you're doing a voiceover for Cheetos, or, and when that's not working, maybe, you know, you've got a cartoon going or, you know, something like that. So, and then to be able to break into in doing dramas, it just kind of reinvents you, and you get to meet that many more casting agents. And but, you know, it goes back to do the work, Don. You got to prepare, and you got to be, you know, you got to do the work. You got to, you know, really prepare to do drama and be ready and have it in your memorized so much that you can really act and not have to worry about thinking up the word or, you know, remembering the words. You got to have the words ingrained in you when you get on the camera. And, you know, you never know, you know, some of these things you work on, if you're going to get a second take, that might be it. So you've got to be ready and, you know, and be in the moment. And you got to have your lines down to not be able to do that.
Do you have one or two memories from touring with Who's Live that really stand out for you?
No, they're all vague memories. So I don't really. do any really stand out on the Who's Live thing? No, because, I mean, we're going to do 101 shows this year, so there's a lot of memories, and, you know, it's really a rush to, you know, come out, and, you know, Styles comes out to huge applause every night. I've never been on the television show. I did an 8-hour audition 15 years ago, and they've never called me. Supposedly I had gotten the part. They never called me because, you know, the show now, they always have Wayne and Ryan and Colin and then one other. So there's a lot of one others that they go to before they call to somebody in the bullpen. So they come out to great acclaim, and there's, you know, some real Who's Line groupies that come to the show. And a lot of them don't realize that I've been on anything. They don't know me from Adam. And, you know, you come out after the show, and those guys are signing autographs, and I'm just standing there with the piano player talking kind of thing. But any particular memory, they kind of come together. I mean, we just replayed again Normal, Illinois. We went there a couple of years ago, and it was Parents Weekend, and they had us in this huge auditorium. And because it was Parents Weekend, people just kept walking up and coming. And like, yeah, I like that Who's Line. You like that Who's Line. Let's go see that instead of sitting at a Perkins Cake and Steak all night staring at each other. So we had like 4,000 plus people in this auditorium. So that was one where, you know, you said a line and it was like a wave of laughter. You know, it was really, you had to surf the lines to get your next line in kind of thing. So that was one that particular that kind of blew me away, that to play to a house that big doing improv comedy. It was, you know, coming from doing it for 14 people in the back of a Chinese restaurant where I started, that was pretty cool.
Deep dish or thin crust?
I'm a thin crust guy. I like to have a half a pizza. I don't like to have one piece and be full. But yeah, no, I like Italian sausage and thin crust. I went to school in Italy, so that's all thin crust. But yeah, the deep dish Chicago, that's nice once a year maybe. But if you're going to have a pie, I want pretty much my own whole pie.
And have you ever been to the Wiener's Circle and hurled abuse?
Oh, yeah. And asked for a chocolate shake? It's fun. It's really it's a good show, and you know, you usually end up there about 2:30 in the morning, fully lubricated. So it's a good show. If you're ever in Chicago, check it out, and ask for a chocolate shake, because they don't have chocolate shakes, and you may get flashed by a large black woman. So that's fun.
We mentioned Holiday Hell. I know you have another project in the work as well called Monuments. What can you tell us, if anything, about that film?
That was Jack Newell, another director that calls me up and says, hey, you want to do this part? I don't know about Monuments. What's going on with that? I got to shoot a nice scene at the Museum of Science and Industry here. That was fun to be backstage there and have, you know, the ability to run around the museum empty at night. We got to work again with Marguerite Moreau, and she's really nice and really fun, and Jack Newell, the director. I'd be interested to see that. I haven't seen that one yet. I don't know how that one came out yet, but I'll look forward to hearing anything about that.
Yeah, all it says on IMDb is that it's in post-production, which is, you know, can always be quite quite vague.
I did a really cool film here in Chicago. I got to work with my wife and my son. My son is hooked up. He's in production here in Chicago, and he's got some really talented artistic friends. And this guy Max did this film. They changed the name of it. I don't know what the title is now, but it was. I'm looking forward to seeing what happened with that too. So it's funny. When you're busy with the Who's Line, you try to do, you know, independent films and small films when you can, you know, get some work and keep my agent a little happy because he's not getting a cut of this Who's Line stuff. So I do try to get in things, and you know, you don't know what becomes of them. You go and you work, and you're done, and then it just kind of goes out in the ether, and then all of a sudden sometimes it's something absolutely amazing. Like I was in The Artist in 2012. Didn't see that coming. I'm a working man. So you do your work, and then some days you get accolades, and some days you never hear what happened to the thing.
What was it like being part of an Oscar-winning production?
Well, that was a weird thing, in the fact that, you know, it was silent, so there was no sound while you're working. So, you know, Michael Hazovinakis, a fun name to say, the director, you know, he was playing Edith Piaf and stuff while you were doing your scenes. He was playing music and drinking wine a lot, and he was having a great time. And, you know, you're working without words. And you can say words, but, you know, nobody's recording them. So it was really unique in that aspect. And I had a fun time. You know, I had a little part, but I saved the day. I pulled him out of the fire. I was expecting a much smaller French man to pull out of the fire, but he's a big guy. And he learned to tap dance for that. And people just had fun on that thing. And, you know, that was a kind of a labor of love that they got to do. And it was really neat to be a part of. And, you know, I would have never gone to the audition if I didn't have a Vespa scooter, because it was a Friday afternoon in Hollywood at like 5 p.m., and I couldn't have gotten there traffic-wise if I didn't have a little scooter. And, you know, when your agent's trying to get you to go to an audition on a Friday afternoon, and they say, well, yeah, it's a French film. Well, it's a French black-and-white film. It's a French black-and-white silent film. Like, come on, you kidding me? You know, that weekend everything was 3D, and here I'm going to go audition for this thing, but then it ends up winning the Oscar, so you just never know.
What is one film or one type of story that you haven't filmed or haven't been a part of yet that you would like to be?
I would love to do, you know, I direct as well. I would love to direct some of the things I've written, and I got to get back on that. I've written some neat things. Most of them, you know, are teen stories that are set in the late 70s, early 80s, and I would love to direct one of the things I've written, and I constantly, you know, kick myself going, I got to rewrite that. I got to go pitch that to this guy. I got to get on it. But kind of busy. That's my day off. So, yeah, maybe I'll get on that later today.
Well, the new film out is called Holiday Hell, and I believe it opens in select cities starting next week?
Yeah.
I believe, and then wide release as of November 1st, if I'm correct. Joel Murray, thanks so much for your time this morning. Thanks for joining me on your day off, as you say.
All right. Well, you have a good day off, too.
All righty.
All right, take it easy.
You take care. Ciao.
Thanks for having me.
All right, bye-bye.
That was my conversation with actor and comedian Joel Murray. His new film is Holiday Hell. That about does it for me today. Thanks for tuning in. Happy voting, and I'll see you next time. Goodbye for now.
I just like to have a lot of sex.